We tend to associate cutting-edge design with high-end consumer goods, which usually excludes the nearly 6 billion people around the world who are unable to meet their basic needs. They are the focus of an exhibit opening at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum this Friday. It's called Design for the Other 90%. And with me now are the show's curator, Cynthia E. Smith, and two of the designers represented, Martin Fisher of Kickstarter International and Ron Rivera of Potters for Peace. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the show. Cynthia, when another current Cooper Hewitt show, Design Life Now, opened, the New York Times art critic Roberta Smith wrote, "It refuses to take sides on the issue of whether design should aim for social or environmental benefit or serve a relatively decorative purpose." Was this show conceived in response to that kind of critique, or is it just coincidental that these two shows are on display at the same time at the same museum?
I think it's not. It wasn't designed in response to that. It was already in development at that point. But I think that really says a lot about how designers, design critics, students, professionals, nonprofits, designers of all stripes are beginning to be really aware that we need to be looking at more socially responsible design.
Was that something you were thinking about when you were trained as an industrial designer?
That was a long time ago. Certainly we were aware of the larger context, but I think in when I was at a design school, we were not working on particularly on those kind of products.
In your catalog essay, you trace the movement back to the British economist E.F. Schumacher and his book Small is Beautiful, Economics as If People Mattered. How do his ideas translate to design? Was he the inspiration for what's being called the appropriate technology movement?
He was right at the forefront. I have a very interesting story, kind of a full circle story around E.F. Schumacher. He, one of the objects in the show, the Pot and Pot cooler coming out of Nigeria, we were trying to get several of those from Nigeria. And working with Mohammed Ba'aba, the designer of that very low-cost, low-technology object, we couldn't get one. He was going into Chad. It's a war-torn area right now. We had to scramble and find an alternate. And we ended up going to an organization called Practical Action, which is, in fact, E.F. Schumacher, the organization that E.F. Schumacher started in the 1960s, and it's coming out of the Sudan. We had to jump through a few ropes to get the pots, but they are on their way. We should have them either today or tomorrow. So it comes really full circle. He's been an influence back in the 60s all the way to today.
Martin, you're an engineer. How did you get involved with this type of design?
I finished my engineering degree at Stanford, a PhD, in 1985, and looking at my possible job opportunities at that time, I could go teach engineering, or I could have worked for Big Oil or for the military research laboratories. None of that really excited me, and I'd read E.F. Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful. And so I went to Africa on a Fulbright Fellowship for 10 months to take a look at the issue of poverty and technology, thinking that there must be something that could be done. And I went down for 10 months and stayed for 17 years and realized that, in fact, there is a very big need for design for helping to get people out of poverty.
So did you start when you were designing by identifying a need and then designing something to fill it? Or did you think about something and then realize and then think about how you could do it?
It was really a number of years living in Africa and really understanding the people before I think I did anything very useful. But after living there for a while, one realizes that the number one need of the poor is actually to have a way to make more money. Because if they have more money, they can get health care, they can get education, they can get enough food to eat. Without more money, it's very, very difficult. So we really identify the number one need of the poor as a way to make more money. And so we design money-making technologies. And these are technologies that they can buy and use to start highly profitable small businesses. So we look for those opportunities and then design the required machinery and tools.
And so that's why you're represented in this exhibit by two things that have the word moneymaker in them, moneymaker water pump and the moneymaker block press.
Absolutely. And we started off with the Moneymaker Block Press and a Moneymaker Oil Press. And these are very good business opportunities where someone can buy one of these machines, a block press in particular, and mix soil and a little bit of cement and make a very, very strong building block. And by selling these machines to local entrepreneurs, they've started a few thousand businesses. But then we realized that actually 80% of the poor people in Africa are poor farmers, and they have one asset, a small plot of land, and one basic skill, farming. And the best business that they can get into is irrigated agriculture, where suddenly they move from subsistence, where they grow one or two crops a year, to a commercial agriculture, where they're growing high-value fruits and vegetables throughout the year, and especially in the dry season when there are no other crops. So we designed a whole line of human-powered money-maker irrigation pumps that operate like small Stairmaster machines, pull water out of a well or a pond and spray it across a field to irrigate as much as 2 acres of land.
And you've cited some other design principles, including strength and durability, portability, environmental sustainability, and cultural acceptability. That's important. You can come up with something that's brilliant and people say, this is not something that we want to do because it goes against our beliefs.
Absolutely. And here you particularly have to be careful about the roles of the different genders. And for example, if you're trying to promote something to men, which is traditionally seen as a woman's activity, that might not work well, or vice versa. In the case of our irrigation pumps, we had a funny story where one of the things we did is on our early designs, we had the operator stand up at about 2 feet off the ground on the treadles. And we discovered that none of the women were using this. And we thought this very funny, and maybe a woman didn't want to do the work. But when we actually went out and talked to them, we discovered that the women were not feeling very comfortable being 2 feet above the ground, dancing back and forth on these treadles and having their hips at eye level. And they thought it was a little bit too provocative. And therefore, on our new design, we stepped the treadles down so they're as close to the ground as possible to get around that.
How important is it to make them look attractive as well?
In my mind, it's important because when somebody buys something new, and however poor they are, when they buy something new, they want something which is really solid and attractive and modern. And I don't believe that we should sell the poor items which look like they're designed for the poor. We're trying to design these items so they look like they're for someone who's richer, because poor people aspire to be richer, and therefore we should sell them real, solid, good-looking items.
Now, Ron, you're a former Peace Corps volunteer. Did you work in this area, grow out of your Peace Corps service?
Yes. I'm an ex-Peace Corps volunteer in two terms in Panama and Ecuador. And one of my terms in Ecuador, I observed a training going on of a gentleman from Guatemala named Fernando Mazariegos, who's teaching some indigenous people how to make a water purifier. And since I'm a potter and a sociologist, I said, this is the way I want to go. I thought that I had to be a doctor to go help people in other places, but as a potter, we're doing it.
So you're represented by a ceramic water filter, and this is being made in a number of different parts of the world. To your design?
Basically, yes. The original design was made by hand, but we could never standardize it to a certain measurement, somewhat like a 5-gallon bucket, a plastic bucket. So we designed a flower pot-looking design that fits in these things, and they're made out of clay and sawdust.
And they're beautiful, too. That's important here. Aesthetics, again?
Exactly. I used to go in to promote these water filters at NGOs with an ugly-looking plastic bucket and didn't get a very good response. And now I walk in with a very beautiful water purifier, and I stay for an hour speaking with the groups, and usually the person I'm interviewing wants one, so he immediately buys one.
And you're also it's a way of employing local potters, isn't it? Using local clay.
Exactly.
So are there variants, and how do you keep the clay pure?
Good question. That's probably one of our principal problems. Every factory, and we work in 16 countries and 7 new ones this year, so we'll be 21 countries by December. Every country and every clay mine has different clay, so we have to, it's very empirical, we have to do the clay analysis with the local potters, but they know their stuff, so we highly trust that.
And do you know how many of them are in use around the world right now?
There's about 1 million users right now.
There's another type of water filter in the show, the Life Straw. How is that different from the ceramic filter?
It's more industrialized, and according to the CDC, it uses a lot higher percentage of chlorine. Ours is made locally, while the Life Straw has to be imported. So we find our goal is to make, let's say, 100 factories around the world in third world countries, and people can buy their own water filter in their own country, made with their own artisans, with their own clay.
My guests are Ron Rivera of Potters for Peace, Martin Fisher of Kickstart International, and Cynthia E. Smith, who is the curator of a show that opens this Friday at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum called Design for the Other 90%. Martin, you are adamant that your tools have to be sold rather than given away. Why is that important to you?
Absolutely. I think it's very important for a number of reasons. To begin with, giving something away is not fair, because how do you decide to give it to this person and not that person? And however you do it, it's unfair. Secondly, it's not sustainable, because once I give you something one time, and now a few years later when you need to buy a new one or you need to buy a spare part, there's nowhere to go. You're just sitting there waiting for me to give you another one. And thirdly, and maybe most importantly, it creates a dependence amongst people as opposed to dignity. And if somebody pays for something, they're much more likely to use it, and they're much more likely to feel good about themselves.
But you have to price it within their range, and I don't know whether that's below cost.
It absolutely has to be affordable, and so when we design our things, we design them so people can afford them. For example, our best-selling irrigation pump is $95, but we've just introduced a new one, which is $33, and we're soon hoping to get the price down to $24. Now, this price is not subsidized in that the manufacturer, the wholesaler, and the retailer all make money because we set up a supply chain. We have 550 retail shops that sell our products in Kenya, in Tanzania, and in Mali, where we work. And it's very important that you get the incentives aligned so that everybody makes money in the supply chain. The subsidy that we do use is for market development, because we're introducing a brand new item to extremely poor people, something they've never seen before in their lives, and that takes a lot of convincing. So we use donor funds to do that market development, going out and do advertising, live demonstrations, and all these kind of things, using billboards and radio to tell people, hey, you can get out of poverty if you go down and buy one of these technologies.
And I'm assuming, Ron, that you also have to educate people as to how to use your water filters.
Definitely. Like any water system, water purification system, whether it's chlorinated or not, there's a large educational component that has to go along with it.
Well, with water filters that are used to eliminate bacteria that can't be seen to the naked eye, don't you have to get people to understand the need for such a filter before you can get them to even use it?
Absolutely. We have there's a company, U.S.-based company called HACH, H-A-C-H. They provide small, very inexpensive water testing instruments, and they have developed a very economic product, about 80 cents, that you will, if your water is not potable, it'll turn black. And so that immediately shows the communities that their water is potable or not.
Do you also sell your product, or are
yes,
they given away?
Yes, the idea is to train people to establish micro-enterprise businesses of producing water filters, and those water filters are sold to walk-in people who come and get them, or to large NGOs that can give them away or purchase them or resell them.
By the way, there's a slideshow of some of the items that are in the show at our website at WNYC.org. And Cynthia, tell us about some of the other objects in this exhibit. There are a number of designs for emergency housing, like the Mad Housers and Global Village Shelters. What are their approaches to the problems of housing?
Well, there's a whole range of designs that provide solutions to the underpinnings of poverty in the show, such as what you just mentioned.
Are these for refugee camps or where people would put up shanty towns?
Well, the Global Village Shelters are made out of a triple-ply, biodegradable, very lightweight material that packs flat. Which means that it can be transported easily to areas that are hit by natural disaster. They've gone to Pakistan where the earthquake hit. They've been deployed down in after Katrina, Grenada.
So these are meant as temporary housing.
These are absolutely emergency temporary shelters, and they don't need any kind of tools to put them up. Now, the Mad Housers Hut is a great example of an all-volunteer organization Georgia Tech architecture students back in the 80s decided they saw this problem with homelessness in Atlanta, Georgia. They said, what can we do? So they came up with this very simple, low-cost design for a simple shelter. And then they went out and found people who found themselves homeless. And they build them prefab, prefabricated, and then in an afternoon go out after they've met with their quote-unquote clients and then put them up in an afternoon.
There's even a Katrina furniture project which uses wood recycled from hurricane debris to make furniture.
This is an amazing response to what happened down in New Orleans. There's a organization called Green Project where they go in and they disassemble houses and then reuse them. They were in existence before Katrina. And so an architect out of the University of Texas, Sergio Pallaroni, connected with Green Project, and they found that they had extra lengths after they disassembled these houses, these beautiful lengths of cypress from over 100 years ago. Because as we all know, the houses were left standing. It was a flood. It wasn't the wind shear that took them down. So what they've decided is they're going to create workshops within these more, the 9th Ward, the 7th Ward in New Orleans, and teach people how to rebuild. It's going into some of the, there's a church pew that's going into some of the churches that have been devastated, working with the Churchill, the Council of Churches, their stools and tables.
And we have very little time, but could you tell us about some of the technological things, like one laptop per child and the Internet Village ModoMan?
The one laptop per child, this is a great example of an idea where using new technology, nonprofits work with regular design professionals like Fuse Project and Continuum in this collaborative effort to work with the developing world, governments, the developing world, and really we have the final one that's going to be, I don't think it's been shown anywhere else, it's going to go into the developing world working with governments and help children learn to learn. This is what Seymour Papert said in the 60s or 70s. It's really a wonderful example of bringing education to the developing world.
And the show, which is called Design for the Other 90%, is on view until my birthday on September 23rd. My great thanks to Cynthia E. Smith, who is the curator of the show. And a reminder, you can see some of the pieces on our website at wnyc.org. Also here are two of the exhibitors, so two of the designers who are being shown, Martin Fisher of Kickstart International, Ron Rivera of Potters for Peace, and it's been a great pleasure to have you all on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.